Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
It is back to school season, and as parents and teachers get ready to jump back into the classroom, I wanted to talk a little bit about the rights of students and parents that might affect you. And with us to discuss these issues is Stephen Glink. He has been an attorney for 46 years. He started at the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, Juvenile Court, fighting for kids accused of crimes, and he's practiced in the area of school law for about three decades. That includes school discipline, special education, teacher-principal dismissal. He's won many awards for his work, and I thank you so much for joining me, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Karen, and good afternoon, everybody. Hope everybody's doing well.
Let's talk about homeschooling. It's really interesting that the homeschooling has really jumped in popularity, I think, during COVID. And many, many Illinois kids are being homeschooled. I think the last statistic I saw was between 170,000 and 210,000. And until recently, there hasn't been a whole lot of regulation. Is that fair to say? And if you can tell us about any new laws that have been passed.
So for the most part, yes, Illinois has virtually no regulation, no oversight of homeschooling. In other words, whoever's doing it, if it's a parent, you don't have to prove that you're a competent person to teach your child chemistry. You don't have to submit attendance records. You don't have to submit any class hours work or anything like that. The state and the State Board of Education have pretty much left this alone. Now, recently, Illinois House Bill 2827 was introduced February 5th of 2025, which creates the Illinois Homeschool Act. It hasn't been signed into law yet, but it's going to be.
And what is that law going to say, Steve?
It really changes the whole landscape of homeschooling. And, you know, what I want to add is one of the points you mentioned is why it's been left alone and why more kids are being homeschooled. This is a real political issue. I think a lot of it originated, as you said, during COVID over masks and vaccinations. You know, parents just didn't like being told what they had to do. And Illinois law now gives the school board and the school administration 100% discretion on curriculum. In other words, parents have no legal rights about curriculum. So I think a lot of parents didn't like that either, especially, you know, the anti-woke movement. Just a lot of parents opted out of it.
And, you know, and then there's been some recent Supreme Court case that basically gave parents the right to opt out of certain programs that they didn't agree with having to do with LGBTQ, right? I mean, so that's yep. That's very, very, very interesting. So this new law that's being probably going to be passed, what is it going to require homeschooling parents to do?
Well, first, it's going to require them to maintain an educational portfolio. And it will require that the parents submit a notification form by September 1st of every year, either to the public school district or the superintendent or the regional office of education, you know, stating that their child is being homeschooled. And then there's a record retention rule that the school will submit, you know, will retain the records submitted by the parents for no more than 5 years after the child would have graduated. But it's also going to require that the parents maintain some sort of content-based educational portfolio. Because, you know, right now, and I think this is a question for a lot of parents down the line, I've never had a client call me and say, well, I homeschooled my child, but the university where I applied, the college where my son or my daughter applied, they're questioning that. I think, obviously, there's a lot of online education now, and there is for homeschooling, too. But if you're applying to college or university and you're homeschooling your child, colleges and universities are free to question whether the child is competent to, accelerate into college and university programs.
So if that's the case, then this is going to probably help them, because at least the parents will then have proof in some way, at least some contemporaneous notes about maybe the child is being taught American history or, as you said, chemistry or the like. And so that will actually help the kids get into college?
My feeling is yes, but I want to say there's a lot of, this is a very hot political issue now, and I think some of it is just parents do not like to be forced and being told what to do. You know, so they want the free hand to educate their child as they see fit. Right now, that's what it is. And I think some of the people on the other side of the coin are questioning the wisdom of just letting parents do it as they want, because, you know, I could tell you right now, even though I've been a lawyer for 46 years, I would not be competent to teach my child high school science or math, anything like that.
I would second that, and I would throw algebra in there, too.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Here's what I think parents need to understand. I mean, this is a very important decision in the life of your child, especially once they get into high school. But homeschooling is considered private education. And one of the things that goes along with that is if your child is not enrolled in your public school district, they have no legal right to participate in any extracurricular activity that is offered by the local school district. And their right to access special education services is extremely limited. So these are decisions that, you know, parents have to really think it over and, do your diligence.
Yeah, and I suppose the you can say, as much as you may not love every book that's being assigned for the child to read and all of the downsides to public education, you do get all of those public benefits for your child. So interesting, very, very, very interesting. Let's switch to another topic, and that is a child's rights in school when it comes to, let's just say, dress codes and hairstyles and things like that. We see a lot of these things in the news. Some kid wants to have long hair and or wear something to school. What are the rules, and how can the schools enforce a child's way that they dress and they style their hair, say?
Okay, so first what I want to let people know is all these types of rights all circle back to one very, very long-established general rule of law, which is that the schools have a legal right to control, monitor, slash prevent the serious disruption of the school environment. And I think a lot of times in my experiences, when the schools try to regulate speech or dress or hair, their biggest claim is it's disruptive to the school environment. So, for example, back in the Vietnam War days, there was a lot of protests about the war. But some of the most interesting cases came over shirts. And in those cases, the courts generally held that a shirt that is not hateful, that is not threatening, and does not cause a serious disruption, and that's what they still look at today, that schools have to let these shirts in there as a form of political speech. Political speech is a very highly regarded thing, but in a school, it's a lot more limited. When you're outside at the Federal Plaza, you can pretty much wear any shirt you want. You can say anything you want. But when you're in the school does not want people wearing shirts or making statements that are offensive and that are disruptive to the school. So that's sort of the big thing. Hair is a sort of a different thing, and I think a lot of that has, I would say, sort of gone by the wayside on the issue of length and all that. A lot of African Americans And people in the religious sector have different terror ideas, so to speak. And the school generally cannot, you know, a public school anyway, private schools can pretty much do whatever they want. But public schools, they generally can't tell a student, you have to cut your hair, it's too long. That was the case, you know, when a lot of the African-American community had way different hairstyles, and then schools were trying to force them to cut their hair. And a lot of those cases, the school district lost those cases because there was no rational basis. The hair length, the hairstyle was not disruptive in and of itself. Now, keep in mind, that may be a totally different issue if you're in an extracurricular activity, because laws vary between public school attendance and public school extracurricular activities. So, example, if somebody has super long hair and the football coach says everybody on the team has to have their hair cut at the neckline, that's probably enforceable as long as it applies equally to everybody and there's no, you know, race-based or religious-based reason that they're demanding it. What the schools generally do enforce it is issue penalties, you know, suspensions, detentions, and that's when we get into court and say, you know, this is a violation of their First Amendment rights, so to speak.
Thank you for joining me today. I'm getting a lot of texters who don't like our school system saying that, you know, parents should have the absolute authority to put their children through school and that children get bored and they really need to be able to do what they want to do. That's really a kind of a sea change from when I was going to school. Do you kind of agree with that? That I think that my parents were like, go to school, listen to your teachers, you know, read the book they tell you to read and not question what they did. I don't know if that's good or bad, but do you see that change in people's attitudes?
Yeah, and I absolutely think this is an evolution of the times. I mean, listen, my father was the school board attorney for the high school I went to. So, and he was a Mr. Law and Order. So he was do what they can say, keep your mouth shut and just graduate.
That's right. Well, you didn't turn out so bad, so I guess that worked for you.
Not at all.
So let's talk about social media, because I just find this to be very interesting. And again, I think we have to distinguish between public schools and private schools. And first of all, before we get into the social media, can you explain why social media regulation, if you will, if you want to use that word, in a public school is very different than a private school?
Very simple, because the public school is an arm of the government. And the First Amendment says the government really says Congress shall make no laws restricting speech. And then that's adopted to the states via the 14th Amendment. So if public schools try to regulate speech, that's an act of the government. Private schools, parochial schools, they are not the government, so they could pretty much do whatever they want. The law in private schools, parochial schools, is mostly governed by the contract that the parents sign with whatever private or parochial school they're in. But, you know, the bottom line, if the principal says, take down your social media page, you can't say that. It's not a violation of the First Amendment because it's not an act of the government. And one other thing I want to add here is that, you know, people think that they can say and do whatever they want, and that's protected by the First Amendment. But what I want people to understand is the First Amendment is not an absolute guarantee of free speech. Karen, you'll know this, but you know the main example we always get in law school is you cannot stand up in a theater, a public movie theater, or a concert venue and yell fire, cause an evacuation, mass tragedy, and say, well, I had a First Amendment right. And even though the theater is not a government actor, your conduct is not protected by the First Amendment. Threatening speech, hateful speech, these are types of speech that are not protected by the First Amendment.
And so let's talk about social media. And you see these cases where kids may be on their breaks, say on their summer break or, you know, on the weekend, they're saying things on social media and the school tries to rein them in by disciplining them. What is the rule? Is it more difficult to run afoul of the First Amendment if the kids are out of school versus in class, in the playground, on the school premises making these statements?
So these cases require the analysis of a lot of individual facts. So number one, are you using a school device to express your opinions? Two, are you doing it on school property? Three, are you doing it on school time? But mostly what it comes down to is, do the comments, whatever you're saying, are they disruptive, threatening, harmful to the delivery of educational services or school environment? So, for example, if a student goes on a Saturday morning and posts on Snapchat, "I want to kill the principal and all the teachers," that is not going to be protected speech because it's disruptive, it causes controversy, it's hateful. It's not going to be a protected class of speech. But in 2021, the U.S. Supreme Court, who is a really kind of an interesting decision, the Levy case, L-E-V-E-Y, a student who was cut from the dance team the next day went on her social media platform and, using a variety of obscene tirades, expressed her opinion about the coach and about the school and about the dance program. She didn't threaten anybody, but they said, "Well, we don't like it. We think it's disruptive, so you're going to be suspended." The U.S. Supreme Court said it was not threatening. It just said, you know, the coach is a piece of whatever. And they said there's no reasonable disruption to the school. This is an expression of political opinion, and it is protected speech. So a lot of it, these are all going to be questions of fact, depending on what is said and where, how, when, and all that. But this court in particular is moving towards more protection of the student and moving away from giving the Board of Education or the administration carte blanche in regulating what students and parents can say.
We only have a few minutes left, but I want to get to this issue right away as far as bullying goes. And we've had a lot of guests in the past talk about bullying and the problems in the workplace and the problems in school. Can you give our listeners just a few bullet points? Your child is being bullied in school or on social media by schoolmates. What are the best ways to handle this, Steve, without hiring a lawyer? What do you do first, and what do you do to try to solve the problem?
Okay, here I'll give you the blueprint, and then I'll give you my editorial comments on it. You have to report it right away. I think one of the and document the report. One of the things I think a lot of parents complain about is, first of all, a lot of times the kids don't even tell the parents. I think it's essential for parents to make sure that their children understand that every incident of bullying has to be reported. So make sure your child knows, no matter what, even if it seems minor, make sure your child tells you, and then you report it by email or letter or something, and that's provable, that's documentation. And it's important to document everything, because a lot of times the parents will take it, you know, sort of the high road and say, "Well, I'm just going to call the teacher, I'm just going to call the dean, I'm just going to call the principal, and we'll handle it there." And guess what? When it comes around to a problem, we never heard from the parent. There was no phone call. So
in writing, an email counts. We've got about 20 seconds, Steve.
It does. And I would just say follow through. Now, here's the problem to me. Illinois law does not require the school board or the school administration to respond in any particular way. And while I think most school administrators try to do the right thing, they can do whatever they want. They don't have to suspend the bully. They don't have to expel the bully. They don't have to discipline this bully. A lot of them have these restorative justice programs where they just sit down with the bully, the parents of the bully.
Try to work it out.
Try and talk it out. Yeah.
So
but it's not always effective.
Yeah.
And the law does not make them accountable. So it's really a tough road for parents.